This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane, coming to you from Nipaluna, Hobart. Ukraine is reeling from one of the most intense airstrikes since the war began, which Russia says is revenge for a weekend attack on a Crimean bridge. Dozens of missiles landed in cities across the country, killing at least 11 people and ruining the relative peace in the capital, Kyiv, and other major cities. World leaders have labelled the attacks as heinous, barbaric, and cowardly. Europe correspondent Isabella Higgins reports.
Morning rush hour in Ukraine turned into a race for survival. Wave after wave of explosions were felt across the country. In the capital, hundreds sheltered in the city's deep metro station, singing Ukrainian folk songs to comfort each other. Above them, a bridge built as a sign of friendship between Russia and Ukraine was blown up. An attack on a children's park turned cosmopolitan city streets into a battlefield. Kyiv's mayor Vitaly Klitschko says mostly civilian targets were hit.
People is angry, and want to defend our houses, defend our families, our children.
Emergency service workers begin a difficult cleanup. Olena Somik fled the capital to escape the horrors in her hometown of Kherson. She can't believe this is happening months into the war.
They want to destroy our people, our infrastructure, everything. I really don't know, and I'm extremely angry, you know. Why?
Ukrainian officials say 81 missiles were fired, 43 of them shot down. They landed in a number of cities from Lviv in the west to Kharkiv in the east and Zaporizhia and Dnipro in the south, destroying apartments, homes and energy facilities. President Volodymyr Zelensky says there's been widespread electricity outages.
We are Ukrainians. We help each other. We believe in ourselves. We restore everything that is destroyed. There may be temporary power outages now, but there will never be an interruption in our confidence.
Moscow says the attacks are a retaliation for an attack on a Crimean bridge at the weekend, which Ukraine has not taken direct responsibility for. Russian President Vladimir Putin has blamed Kyiv's secret forces for the blast, while threatening further escalation.
If the attempts to carry out terrorist attacks on our territory continue, Russia's responses will be tough and proportionate to the level of threats posed to the Russian Federation. No one should have any doubts about this.
Belarus's leader Alexander Lukashenko says he's deploying his troops to help Russian forces near Ukraine. No side is willing to back down in this war, and ordinary civilians will continue to pay the price. This is Isabella Higgins in London, reporting for AM.
Australia's condemned the multiple missile attacks. The Deputy Prime Minister and Defence Minister Richard Marles has told Sky News it's unprovoked aggression.
Well, these were really appalling attacks. They've obviously been launched with a complete indifference to civilian casualties. I was actually with the Ukrainian ambassador when the news broke about this, and the sense of heartbreak was really palpable.
Meanwhile, in cities across Ukraine, some residents are spending the night without power. Others are still in shelters. Sarah Ashton-Cirillo is a freelance journalist. She was in Kyiv when it was hit, and she's speaking here with reporter Matt Bamford.
It was shocking, and that's not an understatement in this case. I was supposed to go home. I live in Kharkiv, a city that has experienced terror for the entirety of the war. And this morning I was doing some last-minute paperwork in Kyiv. I was in my apartment, and I heard a noise, and it was the sound of a missile striking and the crunching of metal. And so it took about 10 seconds, and then I heard another strike, and I looked outside, and I saw that smoke plumes were rising up from behind some buildings very close to where I live. And I went downstairs, and within 200 meters or so, I noticed that there was a trail of glass. And then going up a very slight hill, I came to the strike site that I covered this morning, which was near a park. And at an intersection, there were burnt out cars, bodies that were charred. And I was there within a few minutes of the strike hitting, so it was all very fresh. The first responders were still working. I know from that point, multiple other strikes came down in Kyiv, along with the rest of the nation. I checked in with my friends in Kharkiv. And then the rest of the day was very eerie because the shops were closed and the streets were very empty. So this was extremely jarring to those of us visiting, even though we're used to the terrorism, and even worse, I think, to those living here who had been able to achieve some sense of normalcy in their life.
Yeah, tell me more about how locals have reacted to this.
There was a sense of outrage. I even had some locals confront me about my reporting. There was this sense of innocence that was destroyed. And in speaking to the locals, the only word to use is stunned.
What are things like now? I believe it's later in the evening where you are.
We're approaching 10 p.m. There's power outage in my building. We were told about an hour and a half ago, prepare for massive strikes to hit. There was even some rumors or warnings going on that there were 200 plus rockets in the air. That didn't come to fruition. But the police are on the streets. There's a heavier military presence than I had seen over the course of the weekend. And ultimately, there's an eerie quiet outside. Because, although it's not a complete power outage throughout the entire city, multiple buildings and multiple blocks are without power. And so it's entirely different than the robust, bustling Kyiv from 24 hours ago.
Freelance journalist Sarah Ashton-Cirillo in Kyiv, speaking there with Matt Bamford. Wherever you live, you probably know how hard it is to get a GP appointment. And if you want a clue as to why that might be happening, just 1 in 8 medical students is choosing to become a general practitioner. Limited exposure to what GP life might be like and a poor perception of the career are some of the reasons. And why a roundtable meeting between experts and politicians is being held today to come up with some potential solutions. Political reporter Dana Morse has more.
Medical student Jasmine Davis has always pictured becoming a rural GP and giving back to her community, like the one she grew up in on Victoria's Bellarine Peninsula.
And I've been really lucky that I've had placements in medical school entirely in rural and regional areas and that they've been really rewarding. It's just been fantastic to be able to see how a GP can follow people throughout their whole life journey.
Now the president of the Australian Medical Students Association, she advocates for the importance of general practitioners, but she's one of only a few in her class considering the pathway.
It is possible to go through your entire medical school and maybe only have, you know, 4 to 6 weeks in GP, and then you could possibly go and do internship in a hospital and have no time in GP.
President of the Royal Australian College of GPs, Dr. Karen Price, says fewer people are choosing general practice partly because respect for the position has been eroded.
There's been a general devaluing of general practice, which is manifested through many ways. And medical students are smart, capable people. They're going to pick up where they can go to get the quickest return for all their hex debt and their investment of most of their 20s.
She says there needs to be a total restructure of the approach to primary healthcare to attract new doctors to the role.
General practice, because it's so large, has been very easy to whittle away a percent here, a percent there. You know, it's short-term thinking and it's band-aid thinking. You know, we can't keep having bureaucrats tell the government that there's not enough money because there's not enough money for general practice to fail.
The Federal Health Minister, Mark Butler, says he understands the problems facing the workforce and what the shortfalls will mean for Australians.
I don't think general practice has been in a more parlous state than it is right now at any time in the 40-year history of Medicare. It's critically important we turn that around. People think it's hard to see a GP right now, and Australians tell me it's never been harder than it is right now. That's going to become even worse.
But with a debt-constrained federal budget, there's only so much money on the table to fix the problem.
About 8%, I'm advised, of the health budget goes directly into general practice. We'll see an investment of $750 million delivered in next year's budget into strengthening Medicare, and we're working through what the best priorities would be for that investment.
Jasmine Davis says students need to hear the positives if they're going to consider general practice.
When you're in the hospital and you go to an emergency department, you might see a patient and then possibly never actually see them again and know what happens to them. A GP career is fantastic and can be fantastic. I love that you can be, you know, an instrumental part of people's lives throughout and have that continuity of care.
That's the president of the Australian Medical Students Association, Jasmine Davis, ending that report by Dana Morse. One of the most significant pandemic health measures, mandatory isolation, ends this week, with COVID increasingly being handled like other infectious diseases. And like other viruses, vaccines are regarded as the best defence, yet experts are worried that boosters for COVID are being underutilised. Right now, the eligible population who've had a fourth dose is just over 40%. Sarah Sedgi reports.
Earlier this year, Adelaide GP Dr. Alvin Chua was running around 9 COVID vaccine clinics each week from his practice. But with fewer people coming forward for their booster, he's now only holding 3 at the most.
It's definitely down from before. We used to have many more clinics open, but we've now shut down quite a few of the clinics because it just doesn't make sense to have staff dedicated with the numbers booking in aren't there anymore.
What's most concerning to him is that there are many people in his community that are eligible for a booster but not coming in.
I am worried in the sense that there appears to be a let it loose attitude at the moment. And I guess people like you, myself, we probably will be very much okay. But unfortunately, it's the vulnerable patients, people like my mum, people like my elderly cancer patients or diabetics who are actually going to be the ones affected. But unfortunately, it's hard to convince people to have their booster vaccines.
This week marks the ending of one of the most significant health measures of the pandemic, mandatory isolation. Although there are exemptions for people working in high-risk settings, it's another step towards COVID being managed in a similar way to other viruses. Though health experts like Professor Julie Leask from the University of Sydney are worried one of our best tools against the virus is still not being used enough.
At 41% of people eligible having had a fourth dose, we do have a bit of vulnerability in the community, but that vulnerability extends to people who are more at risk of severe disease. So, for example, Aboriginal people, Torres Strait Islander people over 16, we have fourth dose coverage of only 34%, and even for third dose, 56%. People who speak a language other than English at home, where we saw the highest death rate, we're only seeing 69% having 3 doses or more. And then there's huge disparities based on what your postcode is.
A second booster, or fourth dose, is recommended for everyone over 50 and for younger age groups in care facilities or with more complex health needs. Anyone over 30 is also able to access a fourth shot. For children from 5 to 11, 2 doses is recommended, but only 40% have received the 2 jabs.
The risk of another wave is definitely there. There are concerns that we could have another wave before the end of the year. So for those people who haven't had their booster, now's the best time to get it before we get that wave.
At last count, daily COVID cases across Australia were around 5,000.
Sarah Sedgi reporting. Many parts of regional Australia, large-scale solar and wind farms are found on the outskirts of many towns and cities. But a new report suggesting more effort needs to go into encouraging smaller renewable projects on farms and in communities to help encourage the transition to a net zero emissions future. Jess Davis reports.
On Ian Brimblecombe's cotton farm near St George in Western Queensland, there are also 1,000 solar panels in the paddocks.
I've installed probably nearly 0.5 meg of solar on different places around the farm to help offset my pumping costs.
And while he only needs them to power his irrigation for 1 month a year, he reckons it saves him about $60,000, which is why it makes no sense to him that local distribution network rules are preventing him from maximising the use of the mid-scale system.
I can't transfer power from one pump station on my property to another pump station, for instance. I'm limited in how much I can export.
As state and federal governments aim to increase their renewable energy targets, farmers like Ian Brimblecombe believe they can be part of the solution.
We've got the Queensland government just last week announced that they want to get to 70% now. I'd be quite happy to help them do that, but at the moment I can't.
It's a problem outlined in a report out today by the Farmers for Climate Action Group. It's calling for better regulations, planning and incentives for farmers to benefit from the transition to renewables while adding more power to the grid. Report author Karen Stark, a cotton farmer from Narromine in New South Wales, says governments are too focused on large-scale renewables and are overlooking the contribution agriculture could be making.
We need to set a target for agriculture for renewable energy use. We actually don't have a baseline at the moment of what the renewable energy adoption has been across the sector.
The report recommends the federal government create a national climate change and agriculture policy and provide incentives and subsidies for projects like on-farm battery storage.
If we are able to support farmers and regional communities to implement their own 1 to 5 megawatt solar farms on the existing distribution network, it can reduce the need for really large-scale solar that some regional communities don't really like.
And Karen Stark says changing distribution networks would allow farmers to share power with their neighbours and close-by communities.
If we can get this right, it's a really valuable asset for regional people because it could actually reduce the need for so much new transmission lines to be built out.
Federal Agriculture Minister Murray Watt says he welcomes the report and is open to its recommendations.
It shows that farmers are way ahead of the game when it comes to using renewables and employing sustainable methods on their farms. They really just want government policy to catch up and then start showing some leadership.
He says he's asked his department to look at what kind of incentives could be provided to farmers, although doesn't believe an agricultural-specific renewable energy target is needed.
Rather than taking an approach of industry-by-industry targets, what we've done is settle on an economy-wide target, and I know that the agriculture sector is really well-positioned to contribute to that.
That's Murray Watt, the Federal Agriculture Minister, ending that report by Jess Davis. Trade tensions between the United States and China are intensifying with the Biden administration's introduction of new measures designed to slow Beijing's technological and military capabilities. Tough export controls on microchips made in China using US technology have already hit Wall Street this morning, with the NASDAQ hitting a fresh 2-year low. For more on this, I spoke earlier with our senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan. Peter, what's the thinking behind these export controls, given the world's reliance on microchips made in China?
Well, Sabra, these new controls come at a time when the global microchip industry is already facing some pretty major headwinds from the pandemic. Supply chain blockages mean big delays in the delivery of chips used in things like computers, smartphones and cars. But basically here, the Biden administration measures will probably exacerbate that. And while pretty broad, they do target China specifically. US companies will be stopped from exporting critical chip manufacturing technology to China, making it harder for Chinese companies to make their own advanced computer chips. This morning, some of America's biggest semiconductor companies have tumbled between 1 and 3%, taking the NASDAQ to a fresh 2-year low. But it's not just the everyday microchips the US is targeting. Bill Reince from the Center for Strategic and International Security in the US says the measures are designed to make it much more difficult for China to make components that could be used in a potential military conflict with the US.
These are advanced high-end chips that are going to end up in either supercomputers that will be used for things like hypersonic weapons modeling or nuclear weapons modeling, or we expect that these are chips that will end up being used for artificial intelligence purposes in China, including facial recognition and surveillance purposes, which is a big human rights issue for Americans.
And that's Bill Reince from the Center for Strategic and International Security in the US. Peter, this would be hurting Chinese companies as well. How are they reacting?
Well, Sabra, shares in the Chinese tech giants Alibaba and Tencent, trading in Hong Kong, which rely on US chips, slumped yesterday as investors were pretty much spooked by Joe Biden's export control measures. Those companies now have to consider other options for getting the microchips they need, but that could be tough given that other producers like Japan, Korea and the Netherlands are all closely tied to the US and will be under pressure to restrain China's military intentions.
Peter Ryan there. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. The government doesn't think the wealthiest Australians need a tax cut, but it's pushing ahead with an election promise to deliver just that. Today, Insider's host, David Spears, on Labor's dilemma as it weighs up how to dump the policy while keeping voters on side. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.